Okay, I really enjoyed last week's conversation. Now we'll continue today discussing the topic for tonight is the role of the teacher in the therapy process. So we spoke about last time, and I think you also heard from Rabbi Kramer, you know, recognizing the signs that a child is suffering from emotional distress. Yes? I have one here. Okay. Recognizing the signs of a child's emotional distress. And I think you heard, I saw on the handout, yellow, orange, and red flags. And it's usually the signs that we look for most often, traditionally, are signs of anxiety and depression and those type of disorders. I just want to reiterate what I said last week. Traditionally, when a child is sent for an evaluation and you get back a diagnosis, the impression you get, and many doctors talk the language, and many therapists talk that language, is if the child has an illness, like he has a disease, has a discrete illness. I don't know if you read the handout I gave out last week. You see I talk about it there at length. I think it's important, and you'll be much more helpful for the child, to the child, if you'll understand his difficulty as a difficulty in living. Something happened in his life, or is happening in his life, that makes his life more difficult, and that's why he's suffering from anxiety or depression or something else. I want to especially focus tonight, at this point, on a type of problem that we rarely pay attention to early enough. You know, years ago, when I first started out, the only time they ever sent me to school, like children, the only time they ever sent me to therapy is because it's causing problems. That's the only time anybody paid attention. She was depressed and bothering nobody paid attention. But in recent years, there's been much more awareness of picking up signs of trouble, of mental stress, even if the child isn't bothering anybody. There's a type of problem which I hope people will become more aware of. But unfortunately, the way it currently, there's not enough attention paid to it, and that's why the child is being too good. Right? Or being perfectionistic. Not only is that usually not picked up to be a problem, but it's even usually reinforced and rewarded because everybody thinks it's the most wonderful thing in the world. You know, you can't be too rich or too good.
What's too good?
Oh, I'll explain a little. Being too good could be, in fact, a precursor to OCD, to obsessive compulsive disorder, which by that time then people recognize there's a problem, but by then it's much more difficult to treat. What does it mean being too good? So let me just tell you, just another point. There's a sefer that came out in Tovshin Samachay last year. It's called Mikol Melamdai. Came out in Eretz Yisrael by Samachan, came in Eretz Yisrael. So I was very glad to see that they have a whole chapter on perfectionism, written out in Hebrew, perfectionism. Right? And they discuss it at length. They obviously read all, whoever wrote it obviously read all the research, but doesn't quote any of it. And, you know, I was really happy to see that there's an awareness of it. What does it mean being too good? So let me quote what I saw from the Stipler. He wrote like this. He writes, Mishani roya olav, shehu makbid the mitzvahs, v'yoseh machazay nish, tzarech dika achrav. If I see someone who's being more makbid in mitzvahs than the chazay nish, you have to check after him because there's something wrong with him. Okay? Because the chances of some 14-year-old kid being more firm than the chazay nish is probably nil. If you look in the new sefer Darkei Achaim that came out from Ramchal Yehuda Lefkowitz, he also has in many places there he writes about this, about you know the danger of children being young bachurim being overly demanding of themselves and being overly frum, etc. Now, where it usually comes from, usually what happens is somebody who has low self-esteem is filled with feelings of shame, as we spoke about last week, and is trying to redeem his shame by being perfectly good. Yes?
What do you think that means when someone is more makbid than a chazanish?
Yeah.
Who's more makbid than a chazanish?
Yeah, it was different kids. It'll take them like 25 minutes to say Krishna after they repeat it 8 times. Who wash their hands 25 times because, you know, who won't say one word because they're afraid of lashon hara. Happens all the time. It doesn't mean really makbid him. It's obviously being facetious. It means he thinks he's being more from the chazanish. Right? That's clear, yeah. Not really true, because, I don't know, my Baishia, did you ever see a Shishiva say Krishna over 25 times? You shouldn't do that. Yeah. I mean, you know what Rav Huttner says about reading stories about Gedalia, famous letter that he had. Yes.
I don't think the kids realize that they're being worked from. They don't think like they missed the word, or maybe they didn't get their whole hand. It's little things like that that would have them.
Yeah, but I'm saying there's an underlying problem. It's usually not a lack of knowledge. The proof of that is Because very often these kids are sent to Gedolim, and they go to the Gadol Ador and tells them this is not the Mahalach, and this, you should only do this. The Michal Yehuda writes in a Sefer that Shmoneser should never take more than 7 minutes. Right? And he could tell it to somebody, and the guy will still have him 25 minutes Shmoneser, because it's driven by anxiety, it's not driven by anything. It's usually when it's, especially when it's severe, it's not just a lack of understanding or knowledge or misconception.
No, that's the opposite.
Yeah, it's not from Frumkai. They try to believe it is, but it's a reaction to anxiety. I'm saying at war, I understand, but you know, is he doing everything else like the Mashgiach? There's usually signs. You usually tell that there's something that doesn't hang together right when it's not done for healthy reasons. Besides, you know, the Mashgiach was how old and working on himself for how many years? You know, probably many. And this Bacher was. Yeah, but not everybody's vulnerable. You know, there's usually something that makes a kid particularly vulnerable to pick that up. Everybody else saw, and nobody else is doing it. Yes.
No,
I'm telling you, the Raya is, because usually that's what they, first, the Rebbe speaks to the Bacher, he still speaks to the Mashgiach, to the Rosh Yeshiva, to the Gadol Ador, and usually doesn't help. Obviously, the first intervention is to speak to them and see if that works. If that works, then that's fine. Now, as I mentioned before, the trouble is that usually these behaviors are not only noticed, I recognize as being problems, they're very often encouraged when they're not that severe. I spoke recently to a parent of a young, of a 21-year-old boy who, this Bacher, I mean, the father himself told me that he was very abusive to his wife and his children, and they suffered tremendously in many different ways. And eventually, the way his son reacted to all this criticism is he became the perfect boy. He was the most well-behaved. He was always eager to please. He was always sitting in the smedrish. He never went to the playground. He was like the most perfectly well-behaved. He was, of course, intimidated by terror, but nobody noticed that. They just knew he was a perfectly behaved child. Eventually, as he got older, it became apparent to the mother first that the child was totally socially inadequate. He can't interact with people. He had no self-esteem. And eventually, even the father recognized it. And when the boy came to therapy, he started becoming much more open with his father and talking to his father about some of the things that happened. To the father's credit, he admitted it and he recognized it and he apologized to the young man. But at one point, the father, I guess, was feeling very bad about the whole thing, and he asked to speak to me. The boy agreed. I met with the father, and the father was crying to me how not only did he, in his own foolishness, think that this is the proper way to raise children, but the way the child behaved, not only did nobody recognize it as a problem, he was constantly complimented. He'd go to PTA, and the teacher would say, "Hey, your kid, I'll invite all the kids in the school were like your kid." And this mamish was going on even while the kid was in therapy. Everybody's telling the father what unbelievable, how lucky he is to have such an incredibly well-behaved, perfect child. So nobody recognizes it as a problem. And another fellow who was a manal in yeshiva who recently has become more in tune to these issues told me that he remembers he himself, a few years ago, had a bacher who, when he would explain to him something in the Gemara, would keep on asking him over and over again to make sure he got it exactly right, and he'd ask him again and again. And not only did he compliment the boy for this, he would tell the other boys, "You should learn from this boy. Look how he wants to make sure he gets it right." Unfortunately, a year later, he had a nervous breakdown and ended up in the hospital. At that time, he didn't understand this, that this is involved in anxiety, and he, you know, was actually complimenting it. I have here two handouts that speak about perfectionism. You can look at it later if you like, but take that. Oh, so what is the first guess?
What should a teacher do? Students who really ask questions like perfection, to write exactly perfect in our notes, to keep asking, to do not answer them well. What's appropriate?
Well, first thing is not to encourage it. A lady told me that her daughter, who was just learning how to write letters, kept on erasing and writing a letter again, erasing and writing a letter, erasing and writing. But when she went to PTA, the teacher told her, bragged to her, when she showed her the children's, you know, rendition of the ABC, bragged to her that you can't tell the difference from the handwritten and the printed ABC. The teacher was actually encouraging this, you know, to get it perfectly, if not, you have to erase it and do it again. So that's obviously not. Also, so what do? You try to find out what's bothering the kid. You know, which again, a teacher can't always do, but usually it comes from a child not being happy enough with themselves. The first thing you do is tell it's not necessary. It's perfectly fine this way. It isn't necessary to erase it. It doesn't have to be perfect. If that, you know, if that works, that's fine.
An older idea of what everything written
has to be perfect.
Okay.
We'll get to that in a minute about how, you know, how to get the child to recognize that it's a problem. So when the child's difficulty is misbehaving, when a child is misbehaving, I think the first approach of a teacher, a Rebbe, is to show the child that you realize that their misbehavior is a reflection of something that's bothering them. So instead of coming and saying, you know, that you're bad or you know, you're lazy or you're a troublemaker, that rarely gets the child's cooperation. But if you come with the approach that you realize that these symptoms, these behaviors, are a reflection of something that's making the child unhappy, it's much more likely you'll be able to connect with the child. Now, this doesn't mean that you can't set limits. It doesn't mean you have to let the child set fires in the classroom and, you know, and just go along with it. But you could always set limits in a way that is not a put-down to the child. I always remember, you know, Chaim Siegel's a friend of Levarko from Chaim Berlin. I had a lot of shyness with him. And I was always so impressed that even if he had to suspend a child or even send him away from the yeshiva, he always did it in such a loving and caring way that the bacher would continue, the bacher that he sent out of yeshiva would continue coming to him to visit him on Shabbos and in Manchad, continue having a shaykhus with them. Because the way he would tell it to the bacher is, listen, you're a wonderful bacher, I know you're doing the best you can, you know, obviously something is bothering you, but the way your matzav is right now, we're not really geared to helping you here. You know, the way we have the yeshiva here is set up, we're not going to be able to do anything for you. So, you know, we're going to have to try to find you another yeshiva that's geared to helping somebody. And he would really spend days and nights call and try to find the place of the bacher. The bacher didn't feel like he was being thrown out. Right? So even if you have to set a limit, if you tell somebody who's disturbing in class, you first try to ask them, you know, something a matter. A teacher once told me, after she heard me speak, she said she tried it on a girl who suddenly started talking in middle class. Instead of giving her a demerit, which is what she usually used to do, she went with this, she whispered to her, and then, you know, something the matter? She goes, yeah, my grandmother died. And she never would even thought of asking her. She said, yeah, she was very close to her, whatever, and she's very upset. She said, fine, you know, you want to go out and take a walk for a half hour and come back? You know, and the girl then, she came back. She was fine. Yeah. Many Gedolim say that's a prerequisite. Many Gedolim say that Yehuda writes about it, that you can't just kind of throw a kid out into the street. There's a famous story with the Chazon Ish, and some kid did something terrible, was being mashpia badly on other kids, and he said you can send them away. But when the Rebbe came to visit Chazon Ish the next day, he found the Chazon Ish learning with him. So he can't leave him in the yeshiva, he's harming other kids, but he can't just throw him on the street. Yeah. That what? I mean, how young?
How young can a kid accept that he has a problem and it's not just?
I think the child, I mean, I guess if it's a very young child, you can't even perhaps discuss it with him, but he can certainly pick up your attitude. You know, your facial expression, the way you react to it, you know, will give him the message. Now, it's very important to understand, many people, when a psychologist, let's say, tries, when a therapist tries to explain a child's behavior, say, well, you know, the reason why he's behaving this like this and like this is because of this and this reason, it's, many people react as if you're saying, okay, it's okay. It's okay for him to behave that way. It's like you're excusing the behavior, or you're condoning the behavior by explaining it. Explaining a behavior has nothing to do with accepting it or justifying it. It's simply an explanation. It helps to deal with the problem if you understand where it's coming from. It's perfectly okay to tell a kid that, you know, you can't, if a kid's hitting another kid, you don't say, oh, I understand where you're coming from, you know, let him hit it. Say, no, I can't let you hit him. I understand you're upset about something, you know, if we happen to talk to you about it, I can't let you hit it. Now, when you try to elicit from a child, depending on his age and level of development, trying to understand, like, you have to learn, like, the language. A child hardly ever knows why he does something. Most adults, before they become more insightful about their own behaviors, very often have no idea why they do things either. So if you just ask a child, okay, why do you think you're doing this, you're not going to get an answer. It has to be a process. You have to make him more aware that there's reasons. When I ask even a teenager, like, you know, so why do you think you're doing that? That's because I'm lazy. Okay, so how come the day before you did it without any problem? You weren't lazy then. That's an interesting question. I never thought of that. You know, and then you start reflecting. What were you feeling then? Were you upset about something? Were you frustrated about something? A lot of kids, they have to learn a language. Many kids didn't get that at home. They didn't learn a language to describe. There's a lady told me in her house that, you know, they do talk to the kids about these things. So one time her little one, I must have been like 4 years old, comes to the mother and says, you know, "I'm angry at Tati. He hurt my feelings." You know, she had a language to express what she was upset about. You know, so the mother can talk to her about, you know, how her feelings were hurt. But usually many kids can't express it. So it takes a while in speaking to them and trying to elicit from them, like, what was happening then? What were you upset about? And very often the kid will know. They say, "I don't. I just woke up in a bad mood." So there's something happened the day before that may have upset you. And that makes them have more insight. Now, if a child can explain what they were upset about, you can give them ideas, how a different way to handle it. You know, next time you come like that to school and you're upset, come to me before class. I'll try to speak to you for a few minutes. Now, very often, it's very popular today to give sociological explanations for psychological phenomena. You know, when you want to explain why there's a certain problem exists, we try to give like global reasons. You know, for instance, you hear a lot. You know, recently there's been sort of circles, you know, a movement to try to get rid of the kiddush clubs from shuls. Okay, now I can think of about 30 good reasons why to get rid of kiddush clubs and shuls, but what should not be included in the list of reasons is because that makes kids into alcoholics. Right, and it's been written up even by people who should know better that, you know, the reason why that this is one of the causes of alcoholism because of the kiddush clubs in shul. I can guarantee you there's never a kid in the history of the world who became an alcoholic because of the kiddush club. A miserably unhappy kid may find, you know, where to drink there, and that may be the place he gets drunk. You know, as it's very common in chassis today, you see how many unhappy, depressed kids the bachurim there are. You see how many bachurim get drunk at chassis. But, you know, that isn't the cause. That is the venue where it happens. It's not the cause. The same thing with the internet. You know, they write all over the place. There's many problems with the internet, and there could be many good reasons to limit access to the internet, but one of the reasons that it isn't is that it doesn't cause kids to go off the derech. Very often in all these things they put out in order to frighten everybody, they tell me the reason why kids go off the derech is because of the internet. I personally can guarantee you there was never one kid in the history of the world went off the derech because of the internet. A kid who goes off the derech, that's one of the things they get involved with, is the internet. But it isn't the cause. Interestingly enough, one of the articles that in the special issue of the Jewish Observer a few years ago on the dangers of the internet had a beautiful article from Rabbi Kellerman from Neve Yerushalayim, who did a tremendous amount of research about it on it, and he reviewed a lot of it in this article. Unfortunately, they left out of one section, which I saw in the full version of the article on the Eish HaTorah website. But that he had a whole section on what makes certain children more vulnerable to be negatively influenced by the internet. And he writes four factors that research shows. Children who don't have a good relation with their parents, don't have who to speak to about the things that trouble them, have low self-esteem and poor social skills. Those kids are the ones who are most likely to be negatively influenced. Right? But that section wasn't in the Jewish Observer, unfortunately. Yes. Yes, no kid went off the derech. But there's 50 good reasons why not to have television. You know, that's not the issue. They don't go off the derech because they're right. I'll tell you how I can prove it. I once told this to Rabbi Wolpin. I don't think he didn't have an answer for me. I said, if the exposure itself to television and the internet is what caused the problem, there should be 100 times more, proportionally more kids going off the derech in Lawrence than in Monroe. No, I don't think anybody claims that to be true. The average kid, no, yeah, what? You think there are? No. You might say that the kids are less prone or less halic. I mean, you can say what you want, but they don't go off the deck. I'm talking about leaving their parents' way of life. I don't think any therapist claims that the numbers are demonstrably different. That's what I'm saying. So I'm saying you might say that's not a good way of life. You can make a very legitimate argument that has a bad hashpah. But I'm talking about going off the deck. It's a whole different...
Society was not accepted because you're going to watch TV and then feel like you're...
And Hanami, so it's a different problem. But I was like, Hanami, a goofer. Yeah.
But a person, anyone, adult, sees things that he's not supposed to see.
Yeah.
Doesn't have an effect on it.
100% will have an effect on his neshama. It's not going to make him go off the derech. It'll just make him in a lower level of
the mamelas.
If anybody, if a person is nitshalin on a veira, does that make him go off the derech?
That then we have to stop doing nitshalin.
No. But if a guy's connected,
it's not a one-time thing, but this is an addictive thing.
Ramat Tzio Salman told me once, there's no such thing as a dropout. There's only pushed outs.
Yeah, definitely.
It's Moshe. So I'm saying, if a guy's nitshalin on a veira, it may lower his, it may make him upset, it may lower his level of ruchnius.
It's not going to happen. Mamela's going to happen that way.
Depends how it's reacted to.
I'm saying, if you're talking about cause, that could be a cause. Even he himself, there's a certain amount of...
Every kid I've seen who had these serious problems and went off the derech had serious issues with his parents before all that. And this was because of that that drew him to there, was his escape from his misery.
The biggest illustration for the coin, of course, television is a venue. Yeah. And they can demonstrate this in front of television. The Oraya... how come
people
don't
want to get up
in Europe?
Yeah, of course.
It shouldn't have existed. Yeah.
I asked them to show once. I asked them once. Is it when they had that scholar, right? Yeah. The ghetto walls came down. There was exposure to the outside world. Yeah. I asked them once. Is it reasonable to say that the kids who were more likely to have gone off of their, as a result of that exposure, were the ones who had a less good relationship with their parents and the ones who did? He said, don't repush it.
But that's not a stereotype. That could be a reason also, but it doesn't mean it's...
Okay, I hear. I don't want to spend the whole time on that. I hear what you're saying. The same thing, sometimes we give explanations that are superficially accurate, but I think miss the underlying cause. For instance, you see in the summer, very often Atzala puts out a poster, you know, a picture of a teenager with a car wreck behind them, and it says, you know, behind every teen fatality is a parent who said yes. So you might say it's technically true. I'm not even sure if it's technically true, to tell you the truth, because I think usually those are kids who steal the cars when the parents don't give it to them. But Lomer's talking that it's technically correct. I would venture to say that it's usually the kids whose parents don't let them have the car and have to fight for it, and they're driving the car after a 4-hour battle with their parents who drive like maniacs. The kids whose parents give them the car are usually the ones who drive more normally. Now again, that's not to say that's not a good idea not to have kids driving around the country because of the roads and they're not used to it. That's all fine. But again, it superficially sounds right, but it's not, it really misses the underlying factor. Okay, now when you try to get to the usually when you talk to a kid about what's troubling him, it's extremely rare that a child on his own will tell you anything that's going on in his family. No matter what's going on, they'll hardly ever tell you on their own. A, because they usually don't want to tell, they don't themselves don't want to admit it to themselves because of what we spoke about last time, the Stockholm Syndrome. They're too dependent, it's too fearful for them to acknowledge some of the things that are going wrong. And they certainly are embarrassed to tell it, you know, because they take the blame for it, so therefore they're embarrassed to talk about it, as if they did something wrong. Right? So you have to be very careful when you bring these issues up. You know, also you don't necessarily want to open up a Pandora's box, it depends, you know, how much you can do something about it. But very often, there was a Rebbe that told me, I was once spoken in Silver Spring, and a young Rebbe came, told me that he was once... As young Bachrim, I guess I just started for Chumash, and the Bachrim sat right in front of his desk. I guess his Chumash was open, the Rebbe, and the boy absentmindedly put his hand on top of the Chumash, it was blocking his view. So he very quietly, gently asked him, would you mind moving your hand? And the kid burst out crying. So he thought that there's something troubling this kid. And he called him into his room afterwards and asked him, you know, first the kid didn't want to tell him, just crying, you know, he said, you know, something troubling you or something upsetting you. Then finally the kid told him his parents are getting divorced, you know, or something like that. But I mean, he was sensitive, he realized the kid's reaction did not, you know, didn't make sense concerning what happened. Now, again, some people mentioned before, we were talking about perfectionism, you know, how do you know how serious of a problem it is? I mean, it could be a kid misguided, he doesn't know. And very often kids that say who suffered tremendously from depression, you know, for years already, told me that whenever they would speak to a Rebbe about how unhappy they were, the Rebbe always assumed it was in the realm of normal. Right? So the Rebbe would give them a whole drush about, you know, Sheva Yipot Tzadik Vekom, Lulay Nefalti Lekamti, Aliyas and Yeridis, which is all very true and good, and it's taka as a chizik for most people. But when a guy's depressed, that just doesn't cut it. That's not the problem. And knowing the difference, I guess, is knowing the difference between a yellow, an orange, and a red flag. One Bacher told me that in retrospect, he realizes now that he was in Beis Medrash when I saw him, he realizes that throughout Masifta he was depressed. What's his raya? Because every Rebbe in 9th, 10th, and 11th, and 12th grade, we're always telling him to smile. So I asked him, if anybody ever asked him why he's not smiling? Nobody ever asked him that question. Okay, so Zuzi, could I ask? Yes?
So, is there any good,
for
this test to figure out where
Yes, I mean, it's a good question. One is seeing his reaction to what you tell him. You know, giving him physical help so he gets back on his feet, that's a pretty good sign. You know, if you see that it's not helping. Also, you can try to listen more carefully when you ask him, like, what's troubling him. Right? So the Bucker tells you that, you know, last week he learned better, you know, this is not, he's not learning as well as he did before. So maybe he needs a little bit physical. The Bucker tells you that he knows nothing. He spent, let's say you know that he learns pretty well. And he tells you, Mom, she's learning the sugya for 3 weeks, and he knows nothing. It's not such a good sign, because the likelihood of knowing nothing if you learn with half decent asmada for 3 weeks is not too high. You know, if a girl gets a 98 and bursts out crying as if she got a zero, that's not such a good sign. Yeah. So, I mean, usually you can tell if when you talk to the child and try to reassure them and see, you know, if that does the trick, if that helps. It's interesting, the Sefer just came out, Mamash Now, from one of the Ravoldas Talmidim. It's called the Avdei Shleima, and I found something very interesting there toward the end. He talks about how a Rebbe really has to know the difference between a psychological problem and an everyday problem. And he writes there, Zebayana Sheik Yeshu Shlach Miyala Rofet. It's an emotional problem, you have to send them right away to a doctor. It's not always easy to tell, but you know, you just have to be aware that there is a difference. Another problem is that a teacher obviously has certain limitations. You know, you have a class full of kids, and you know, the amount of attention you can necessarily give to one child is limited. And I think it's very important not to promise them whether you can deliver. What often happens, especially with young teachers who are very highly motivated, will sometimes spend hours and hours, you know, talking to a particular troubled student, but it's not something you can keep up. And then when you draw back, either because you're over your head or because you just don't have the time for it anymore, it makes the child, you know, the child feels abandoned. You have to be careful with that. It's also, there's a very interesting point, it's a paradox, I think, that what happens sometimes is, let's say even you're trying to convince a child to go to therapy, the child is resistant. If you spend a tremendous amount of time with a child, you're helping them enough to make them not feel the need for therapy, but not doing enough to help to really cure them. It's like somebody should go to a dentist, but is afraid of dentists, and he's in pain, and you give him a lot of painkiller, you'll help him enough, they shouldn't go to the dentist, but you're not going to cure whatever's causing the pain. Right? So you have to be careful. And certainly not to try to give more time than you really have and you're not going to be able to keep up. There was once a young lady I was working with who was actually thrown out of her house by her mother when she was a teenager, and it was a very wonderful Rebbetzin who really did a tremendous amount for her. But she inadvertently made one mistake, you know, trying to be helpful. She told the girl at one point, trying to reassure her, that I'll be instead of your mother. Right? That, you know, she couldn't really cash that check. But she had to kind of hire her own large family, could not be instead of her mother. And when it came to that point, the girl was very disappointed and angry. Right? And I don't think it was a good thing to promise. She'd say, I'll be as helpful as I can to you, I'll try to do what I can for you. But, you know, when she was getting married, she actually expected this Rebbetzin to go with her, you know, spend the whole day with her every day as if it was her daughter. Yes?
I had to explain to her, she asked me when I didn't have enough time for a very similar situation. And I explained to her very clearly, I spoke to my mentor, and she said basically the same to the girl, that I'm right now I'm a teacher and I'm going to treat like a mother does. I can give to you when I can. Sometimes where I'm giving him and I just can't anymore, I will just give him as I can. I will always care about you. I will always love you. Whether you want it or not, that's your decision. But like, you know, child, that's another I hate when you leave. So, mother, love the child.
Again, I would, you know, fine, I'm glad it worked, but I would be cautious using the word like a mother, right? Because you'll have another class next year and another class the year before, and you know, some, if you're really her mother, you'll forever.
Not like someone that's a finger with her mother.
I'm just saying there's a certain.
The way that a mother takes her child, like, I think you're now next to
you. Yeah, I understand. I'm just saying there's a certain risk. A girl who sometimes is desperately in need of a mother, especially those girls whose mothers are out, will sometimes read into what you say more than you're really offering. And I just think it's better to err on the side of caution.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, now what happens if you have a student who you feel needs therapy, but, is resistant, which often happens? So, what could one do? Okay, so one thing is, again, I think if you try to get to the underlying cause, the underlying root of the problem, it's a little easier to convince somebody. Because usually, the way the child understands their own difficulty is that they're not trying hard enough. They're lazy, not trying hard enough. And therefore, the HC is to try harder. So what do you need to go to therapy for that? Let yourself, you have to try harder, and that's it. So if a child, let's say, could understand, depending again on the age of the child, if a child could recognize that the problem is, let's say, that they have very poor self-esteem, say, or the reason why it's hard for them to try is because, if they get less than 100, then it's a terrible disaster. If they can comprehend that that's not a healthy way of looking at things, they might be more willing to go for therapy than if they, if they just think they're too lazy and not trying hard enough. Another point is like this, that very often the reason why kids resist going to therapy, because very often when a kid's, especially if a kid's misbehaving, the emphasis always is on the misbehavior. The parents are angry they give them misbehaving, the teacher is angry they give them misbehaving. So the focus always revolves around, so how did you misbehave today? So why do you have to go to therapy? Because you're such a bad kid that, you and my mad nafish, and you have to go to therapy. So the therapy ends up being a confirmation of the child's badness. That is not really a high motivator for going to therapy. If the emphasis is more on the child's unhappiness, which is presumed to underlie the misbehavior, so if you tell a child, listen, it really distresses me to see how unhappy you are, right? And this is not an eitzah, then the person is much more likely to be cooperative. It's sometimes I tell parents who tell me that their kid will never be agreeable to come to therapy. Let's say they describe a problem with their child, and it sounds quite obvious that he needs therapy. And the parents are like, no, he'll never go. I say, well, probably not because you've been criticizing him most of the time and explaining his problem is just because he's lazy or doesn't care. If you spend a month or two focusing more on his unhappiness, he may change his mind and be more amenable to going if he sees that as an effort to get him to help him be happier. Now, very often, especially with teenagers, they'll often, very often deny that they're unhappy, right? The kid will come and tell you he's been thrown out of 5 schools, he can't hold a job. You say, well, that must be very distressing to you. No, I couldn't care less. That's very often a defense, and it's very hard to work with them because they will even deny that there's any problem. No, I'm fine with it. No, I'll be a dropout. Who cares? One technique I've often used, I ask the kid like this, I say, so let me ask you something. If a Leon Novi came to you and offered you a magic pill that you could be like every other kid and go to school and get decent grades, would you turn him down? I think only once in asking this question hundreds of times has a kid claimed that he would turn it down. Most kids say, well, yeah, somebody would offer me a magic pill, I'll take it. I said, all right, so it's not that you don't care, it's that you don't believe anybody could possibly help you, and there's nothing changed, so I can understand that you're not motivated to do anything about it because you don't feel it's possible. I said, it's my job to convince you that it's possible to do something about it. Right, so that's something. And another thing also works with teenagers sometimes. A kid is very often masking his own life. He's very so disgusted and so feels so hopeless, he's willing to, but if you talk to him about their children, I said, do you want your child to have this problem? That gets them out of their seat sometimes, I would never do this to my child. Well, if you don't take care of this problem, you will. So that's also sometimes a motivator. Now, this is what you asked before about what perfection is. So somebody has this problem. Those are the most difficult ones to get to go to therapy. In one of my articles I've written about that. Incidentally, one of these articles on perfectionism is a mashgiach in a very chashu yeshiva that read it and told me this unfortunately describes many of us talmidim. So it seems to have hit a nerve. But that's probably one of the most difficult type of problems to convince somebody to go to therapy. Because what happened is, initially, for many years, the perfectionistic strivings is what built this person's self-esteem. This is what made him proud of himself. He always got 100s. He's better than everybody. Everybody else is happy with a 90, but not him. For everybody else, they could be yitzah with a 10-minute Shemoneh Esrei. By them, nothing less than 25 minutes will do. Very often, as a way of counteracting the low self-esteem that's behind the perfectionism, is a grandiosity. He writes, Rav Dessa writes in the Chayot Kei, the Yuchim Leo, he writes that behind Gaiva is Rikshei Nechitut, is an inferiority complex. They play off each other. You know, somebody who truly feels good about himself doesn't have to brag, yes. Oh, okay. But so very often a child will have built up his pseudo self-esteem by being perfectionistic. So by you suggesting that maybe he needs treatment to become less perfectionistic is extremely threatening to them. Even if they're suffering from symptoms of anxiety and stress that comes from their perfectionism, which is very often, and sometimes you have to wait till it gets worse before the child recognizes that it's a problem. I don't know if anybody ever heard of Dr. John Sarno, who treats chronic pains. Yeah, okay. In his book, the last one, The Mind-Body Prescription, he quotes my article on perfectionism. I schmooze with him about it a few times, because he claims that that's very often the source of internal stressors is trying to be perfect. So sometimes it's only when somebody's suffering from either physical pain or enough emotional pain that they recognize that it's a problem. Now, how about convincing parents, especially with younger children, but even with older kids, you know, the parents have to be on board also. And they're the ones who are the source of the resistance to going to therapy. So one thing is that very often the parents try to minimize or normalize the problem. I've been shocked how many times a parent will be sitting with me describing their relationship with their teenager and saying, yeah, you know, we fight all the time, we were screaming, yelling, and breaking dishes, etc. You know, like a teenager. Many, many times. I hear this from kids too, but even the parents. You know, like a teenager. That's like, you put that at the end of the sentence, now call this at that. Right? So I tell them, no, wait a second, this is not like a teenager. Research shows that the majority of teenagers get along very well with their parents. It's a different relationship than when they're little children. And sometimes it's because the parents don't recognize it that causes the problem. But most teenagers get along pretty decently with their parents. Maybe they're not as close as they should be. Maybe it's not wonderful and not beautiful and perfect, but it's decent. And if you're screaming and yelling at each other all day long, it's not like a teenager. There's something wrong. So sometimes you really have to emphasize how problematic the problem is to light a fire under them. They shouldn't just, you know, machavek and put them, sweep it under the rug and not understand the seriousness of it. Very often you have to make it very clear that it's not going to get better by itself. There are certain types of, you know, less serious problems that do get better by themselves, or you can hope that they get better, and sometimes the problem is not going to get better by itself. Sometimes I even tell a parent, if they're really very, you know, they're sort of not cluing in, I tell them, listen, I just want to get it on record that I warned you. I want to discharge my responsibility. Somebody told me that Revolta once told him, somebody was once telling Revolta that nobody's really listening to him, what he's saying about, you know, the proper way of doing chinuch, like in the sefer that he had. Revolta said, listen, I did my responsibility. I can't change the world. I said it. I told everybody. I wrote it. Whoever does it. Do you want to listen? Fine. Don't want to listen. I was yet to my responsibility. I said it. So sometimes if you tell that to a parent in such a lushin, you know, sometimes they're able to appreciate the seriousness of the problem. One of the main issues that parents very often are concerned about is the stigma. Right? It's a very common... And again, there's a reason why some parents are more... I always find it very indicative when a parent... Some parents, when I meet them the first time, and they're considering sending their kid for therapy, they'll spend the whole session wanting to know if anybody's going to see the kid coming into the office. That's like the main sort. Most parents do have some concern about it, but that's like they're more concerned about the kid's symptoms and, you know, the prospects of him getting better and what will help him, what should they do. They also want to know about the confidentiality. But sometimes that's like the whole, that's like mamish, that's all they're interested in talking about. And unless I can sign in blood that there's no possible way anybody will ever see him, then they just would rather leave him home and suffer. I always find it interesting that they're more concerned about the stigma of the treatment than the stigma of the problem. You know, and they also seem to be less concerned about the stigma that they cause, the internalized stigma that the child feels when they insult him. But that doesn't have to say that when they insult him. But the case if you try to help them, that stigma is already unbearable. Yes, go ahead.
I know that the government said that 10-11-year-old child therapy by the stigma of being out in poverty, but that's what we see with the doctors.
Excellent. Right. I very often try to explain to the parents that his internalized stigma of not solving his problem and dealing with, you know, having to live with this problem is going to cause him a lot more aggravation than whatever the possibility of anybody finding out, which is very rare. I, from myself and my colleagues, I never heard such a maisa that somebody somehow found out somebody's going to therapy unless the person told somebody himself. And same thing with shidduchim, you know, which is a very black. The kid's 4 years old and the parents are worrying about the stigma of shidduchim, you know, when he gets married. And again, I found the same thing. You know, the kid being unhappy and miserable is going to affect his shidduchim much more than you know, being in therapy. Yes.
Ma'aseh shahaya. In Lakewood, there was a person that pushed for his child, his daughter, to go into nursery a year younger. So she should be able to get out of seminary a year younger. She would have to work a few years. It's like,
I'm not joking. I could believe it. I could believe it. One patient told me that he told the girl when they were dating that he's in therapy, and she told him, and he asked her how she felt about it, and she said, "I'll tell you, I went out with a lot of guys who should have been in therapy. I'm glad you had enough sense that you went." So again, you know, obviously, you know, anything could be a stigma. You know, if you use the plastic tablecloth I hear in bar parks, it's a stigma. You know, so fine. As the Chazon Ish said, you only have to marry one person. I was explaining to my patients, I just told the patient this yesterday, that, you know, if you're opening up a school, if you open a school, a girl's school, and you want to attract 400 students, so you have to do market research, you want to know what Dalim wants, you know, you have to attract a lot of people. I said, hopefully you're only going to marry one girl. No, so it's not such a big ASIC. Okay, now, also, when you send a child, if you're the teacher and the child's going to therapy, you really have to clarify, first you have to appreciate and respect the need for confidentiality. This could be a problem, right? You know, here you are a teacher, you may have a very wonderful relationship with a child, maybe that's why you were able to convince the child to go to therapy. All of a sudden he has this whole other life that you're sort of being left out of. Many parents have this feeling too. They send the child to therapy, and you know, all of a sudden the child is like telling the therapist things that he's not telling them. So, you know, obviously, it would be work best. First of all, you have to show the child you're okay with it, because if he feels you're uncomfortable with it, it's not going to work very well. I think, let's say, some parents who I think are healthier and they know the kid has a relationship with a rebbe or a teacher, I think some parents, even if they feel a little bad why the child doesn't confide in them, I think a healthy parent is happy at least he's talking to somebody. You know, well, better if he doesn't talk to anybody, it would be better. But that requires a certain amount of health, you know, to be able to appreciate that and not feel competitive feelings. So I think when a kid goes, you have to find out from the child, you should speak to the child beforehand and find out what his level of comfort is. And the therapist, different therapists have different styles and different approaches, how much they involve the teacher. But this is something that a teacher has to deal with. You know, and I think when you speak, yeah. Now, I mean, first of all, it depends how old, but let's say anybody who's, you know, above, I don't know, certainly with teenagers or even older children, you know, you have to assure the child confidentiality. Sometimes you can ask the child permission. Sometimes even if a parent or a teacher or a rebbe calls me, right, you know, wants to speak, I tell him, you know, does your son know that you're calling, or the student? And if they didn't get permission from the student, I said, again, you can talk to him and ask him permission. And very often, if you ask, you don't do it behind the kid's back, very often they're masking. So I usually try to, especially with older, I try to encourage the kid to be more open with his parents. If you have issues with that, I usually, when I meet the parents before I meet the kids, so before there's issues of confidentiality, I tell them that I'm going to encourage your son to talk to you and talk to you about the things that bother him. Please don't make him regret it being open with you, because I'll set back the whole thing for another year. You know, if he's going to regret being open with you, then that's going to really cause problems. Okay, now, there are things you can do to support the process of therapy that a teacher can do. In general, let's say encouraging a child to be open. See, you know, I remember one time, this, I was so impressed. I was once working with a kid and the parents brought him. And the parents said something to him that was so helpful to the therapy, and I so much appreciated it. They told the kid, listen, you know, obviously, you know, you must be behaving this way because something is troubling you. Could be has something to do with what we did. You know, maybe we didn't deal with you right. Maybe we got you upset. You might not be comfortable telling us. Please tell the therapist. You know, we'll be happy. We want you to deal with it. It eliminates the whole problem of feeling guilty of talking against your parents. So the same thing as a teacher. You know, if you tell the kid, listen, it's very important to be open. You're going to therapy. You say what bothers you. Something about me bothers you. You don't want to tell me. So tell the therapist. Giving reshus to the kid to be open is a tremendous help. Yes.
Now, as we as teachers, as parents, we're supposed to ask the therapist exactly what's bothering the child, or we should between the child and the therapist.
You ask the therapist how he works it. You know, again, I would usually, I try to encourage, especially if the kid likes his teacher and has a shtickle shaitas with him or his Rebbe, I try to teach him to be more open with the Rebbe.
Let's say the kid doesn't like the Rebbe, he doesn't like his parents.
Yes.
So, what is it? How is the teacher supposed to react while they're doing therapy?
Yes.
Should you meddle in and try to find out what's going on?
And that was out, you know, again, you have to clarify that before, you know, with ask the therapist what is.
I'm saying with the therapist, you need to try to find out from the therapist.
You could ask the therapist when you make the referral, you know, how's this going to work? You know, is there something you want me to know? Let me know. If it's okay if I call you, you might ask the kid what he wants to do. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. You have to clarify that before so you know how the process works. Now, again, I think one way, I think if everybody recognizes that we're all there to help the child get better, you know, whether, and you appreciate the different roles that a teacher plays and a Rebbe plays, then I think, you know, it's more likely that we'll all be pulling in the same direction. You know, I think, unfortunately, very often, you know, we think the child is there to serve our needs. The Bar Mitzvah Bachar. You should bring nachas to his parents. Right? You know, I've always complained about it for years. And all my friends used to make fun of me, like, you know, my new shagaz. Whenever somebody said that, they looked at me and laughed. So Baruch Hashem, one of the people that make fun of me had the decency to send me from a sefer from the Dalai Lama Chavim to the Brisker Rav. There's a mice of the Brisker. There was once a parent, a father, who was very, very dedicated to his children. And so a relative who was visiting was tremendously impressed, and he asked him, how will your parents, your children ever repay you? So dedicated to them. So the father answered, the children give you a sense of immortality that you live on forever through your children. Later on, I guess he must have been in Talmud with the Brisker Rav, his father, so he told over the Brisker Rav what he was asked and what he answered. The Brisker Rav told him that what you said is part of Lapikorsis. What's that, Biz? He said, because the Rishon doesn't give you children to get anything from them. They don't. The Rishon gives you children, so you should have the opportunity to emulate their Rishon, to give without any chesed and getting back. And he said, you can give parents, you can give the parents a bracha that they should have nachas, just like you give them a bracha to have parnasa. It has nothing to do with the kid. They should have mitzvah. The kid's matzliach. Things go well. They should be happy. But that's not the kid's job. Yes.
Many times, if the kid, that's the right way, the kid has nachas from the parents.
Yes.
The parents do. So then the kid's a lot easier if the kid gives nachas.
That's the bracha I would give. You should have nachas from the parents, and then eventually the parents want nachas too in the chanami. But I'm saying, but if we all appreciate that, I guess sometimes, you know, there's nothing wrong with enjoying teaching and having geschmack from various HaKadosh, it's all very nice, but, you know, then that's not the kid's job. I guess if we all thought that way, there would be less competitiveness and we'll be able to work together more harmoniously. But now, the question is, what do you do? Yes?
You address the issue of the child feeling that it's Russian terror. He speaks with therapist about it.
Yes. So, I mean, this patients very often ask me about the Lashon Hara factor. It's halacha psuka, as it's brought down in Sfarim. Rav David Cohen has told me this many times, you know, that when this is called the Teilis. You're allowed to speak Lashon Hara, I guess, you know, under certain circumstances when it's the Teilis. And Enlecha Teilis, Gdeil Mezuv, this is for the child's health and to recover from whatever is troubling him. It says, yeah, what?
When the child goes to the therapist and then the child comes
over to an entity because
it goes to
you, even
though the they
teacher?
Says, yeah, even though they spoke to the therapist.
It comes from the teacher.
But they say I spoke to two people, and then what happens?
What's the problem with that?
What do you mean? They feel like, I have a student that says, I can't, I go to the therapist, or you have to, I only go to you, but I don't feel like I'm getting better from
it. Okay, well, I was just going to get to that. Yeah, just one second, yes. I can't hear you, I'm sorry.
It's sort of a seven. As far as Lashon Hara goes, for example, a couple of times, one of the conditions necessary for Lashon Hara is that you can't
in doing it out of any indicativeness. If
right,
he
hates
his parents,
yeah.
hates his teacher, then what?
Because, I have one of the handouts here is about honoring parents who are abusive. I have a tshuva from that I wrote, corresponded with Zilberstein in Eretz Yisrael, about this issue where part of the tshuva, sometimes talking about that, again, for health reasons, if that's part of the way the person is going to get better by getting it out of the system and talking about it, so it's again the talus.
No, I know. I understand.
I'm just telling you that's a psak that, again, the gabi, in this circumstance is refua, you know, it could be in other circumstances, it wouldn't be permitted. But the gabi, the question of what happens when the child, the student, is not happy with the therapy or the therapist, that gets a little touchy. Because first of all, it's hard to know, is it just a child's resistance to talking about things? Is it like a problem with the therapist? Is it a problem? Is it a mismatch? It's not so simple. You know, one rule of thumb, you know, it reminds me of a mice I once saw brought down from the Starco, I think it was, that there was a young girl who was engaged, and she got cold feet, and she wanted to back out of the engagement. So the parents came, didn't know what to do. Asked the Stipler, they don't know what should they do. You know, should they break the engagement? What should they do? So Stipler asks the parents, asks the mother, tell me, what happens when your daughter goes to buy shoes? So the mother says, she starts laughing. She says, when the storekeepers see her down the block, they lock their doors. So she comes in, she changes, not happy, and then she just changes her mind and gets another one, brings another one, and she can never be happy with any shoes she got. So Stipler said, then it has nothing to do with the boy. Just she has a hard time, you know, with any decision she makes. It might as well go ahead with her, because it'll happen with whoever it happens. So as if it's punked with this person, she's having second thoughts if he's the right person. That's one type of problem. So again, one way of asking, you know, is try to ascertain, is there something specific about this therapist, or is there something about the whole process that they're not comfortable with yet? The best thing to do, the first thing to do is to encourage the student to tell the therapist that they're not happy. Now, any therapist worth his salt, you know, should know to handle that well and encourage the child to express themselves and discuss with him what it is that makes him unhappy. You know, so that's the, you know, sometimes I've had situations where the child just felt way too embarrassed or just felt that, you know, I'd get up and beat him up or something if he said something like that. And then they ask the teacher. If the teacher can do it, fine. And then the teacher will call and tell the kid, you know, so to smooth away.
Yeah. I mean, does it always happen that the child clicks with the therapist?
No. I'm saying...
Sometimes they don't...
Right. So I'm saying if you encourage a child to give it a chance and to verbalize what they're unhappy about and it still doesn't go, it could be that sometimes it's not... It could be, you know, there has to be a shidduch too over there between the therapist and the kanami. Sometimes you have to try somebody else. Should we take a break now? Okay, another very important point in the process of therapy, just to end off that nekuda, is that very often it gets worse before it gets better. It's like doing surgery. You know, right after surgery you feel worse than before. Hopefully in the long run you'll feel better. But, you know, initially very often it opens up the kids, you know, you become aware of feelings and things that, you know, that you otherwise wouldn't have. In fact, the interesting, there's a fellow that came to me who had a few kids, he's very middle-aged, and he himself, the reason why he came to therapy, because he realized that he's extremely intimidating to his kids. He yells and screams and very intimidating, and he realized he was wrong, and he really wanted to work on it. And he told me that he knew he was getting better when he got a nasty note from his daughter. He says, his daughter's always used to write him how lucky they are, having such a wonderful father, and it's like unbelievable and so wonderful and beautiful. And now, after he was in therapy for a while and he was treating them a little better and being more open to them, you know, he got a letter from his daughter, how mad she is at him and how he always treats her and he's always yelling at her. So he had the wisdom to understand that that's a symptom that the therapy was working. And same thing with kids. I remember once I met with parents who were very not too happy with the way that their son's therapy was going with me, together with Ramat Tzvi Salman. He was trying to help me out. And the parent claimed that ever since he came to therapy, he's unhappy. Before he was fine. Ramat Tzvi says, you can try to sell that to the therapist, but I spoke to him before, that's why he went to therapy, and he was very unhappy. He just didn't have the nerve to tell you, and now he feels that he could tell you. So, you know, you have to be aware that sometimes on the surface, that sometimes it seems to be getting worse before it gets better. Okay, now there are things that you can do in a classroom, you know, to try to reinforce, you know, to promote a healthy emotional environment, which will reinforce what goes on in therapy. It's a good idea to do anyway, even if there's nobody in therapy. One thing is reducing the shame over having a problem and promoting the pride of dealing with a problem. Usually when a child has a problem, the negative reactions for the problem itself makes the kid embarrassed that he has a problem. You know, it's healthier for a kid to realize you shouldn't be embarrassed having a problem. You shouldn't be embarrassed having a problem you're not taking care of. And, you know, if a person feels, you know, I think it was a maestro they say about one of the Gdolim, somebody was speaking to one of the Gdolim about something, and he said something, and he got the impression that the Rosh Yeshiva misunderstood and thought that he's about tshuva. So he said, no, I'm not about tshuva. He goes, and why not? You have to be embarrassed. You have to be embarrassed if you don't do tshuva, not if you, you know, they do tshuva. Now, also, it's very important to encourage a more positive attitude toward the expression of feelings. It's amazing how many, very often, kids are given over divrei chazal, misinterpretations and misunderstanding of divrei chazal. It is very, very rampant. For instance, kids are told that being angry is a terrible aveira. After all, kol hakoydes kila ibn aveira zara. You know, of course, in fact, that's not what the Gemara says. It's a misquote of the Gemara, although the Rambam does say, and the Marzki is asked on the Rambam, he doesn't even have his answer, because the Rambam seems to be misquoting the Gemara. The Gemara says that kol hakoydes kila ibn aveira zara. It seems to be that means that if you lose control over your anger, that's kila ibn aveira zara. It's not the anger itself. And what exactly what the Rambam means, there's many terutzim on that, the Kashan of Ritzki is.
Say, you feel that a lot of the kids are problems, parents are calling
you? I mean, it's a very general statement. I mean, you know, it really depends on. It's usually not. You know, I don't, sometimes when the parents become frum, let's say, they're not sensitive to the child. Sometimes the children are already a bit older. And they sort of force it on the child, they yank them out of one school, put them in another school. I mean, most Bali Tshuva don't do that. I mean, they're aware of these things, and certainly the people who work with Bali Tshuva try to make them aware of that, but it's not the Bali Tshuva itself, it's how things are handled. You know, it's really the issue. And sometimes, because they're insensitive to feelings, which may have happened before they became, but I don't think that somebody becomes insensitive to because of Bali Tshuva. The problem existed before, but because of this radical change in the family lifestyle, it could exacerbate previous problems. Okay, so again, you know, children are made to feel guilty that there's something wrong with them, they're angry. Right? And really, or the same thing that children are told about being mavra al midoysaf. First, I think mavra al midoysaf, the way they understand that to mean, that somebody insults you and embarrasses you in public, it shouldn't bother you, you should go on as if nothing happened. It's very interesting, Revolta has on Dalek Shur a whole shtickle over there about being mavra al midoysaf, and he explains, Barichas there, that it doesn't mean that, you know, you're not supposed to have any feelings. And in fact, he says, if somebody said something to you that most people would not be bothered by it and you're hypersensitive, so he says the answer for that is to develop a sense of humor. That's what he writes. Develop a sense of humor. He says, but if somebody did something to you that's the normal reaction to be upset, not only should you not be mavra al midoysaf, he says, it's a chiyuv min ha-tayra to tell the person. It's also gomer not to tell it. And this is very often misinterpreted to children, is you should never be hurt, never be insulted, no matter what anybody does to you, you should be perfectly fine with it. So that they feel embarrassed and ashamed that they have normal feelings. The same thing with kibidavein, you know, the message children get is no matter what your parents do to you, you have to be perfectly happy with it and have no problems. They're told, I mentioned to some people last time, I don't think I said it to Robin, but you know, they're told the Gemara of the Maestro Dumb of the Messina, that is another ripoff his thing, and he was perfectly fine with it. Nobody bothers telling the kids that Taisus says that she was with the Rebbe's Vedaika, the mother had Alzheimer's. The Yamshir Shlomo discusses the Barichas. I discussed it in this paper about honoring an abusive parent. There's a tremendous amount of misinformation in the name of Chazal that children are taught. It's like telling, oh, it's like you know, somebody who would want to become a sheikh is only learning Hilchos Shita and the Shulchan Aruch without the Nisei Kehillah. You know, there's a bunch of misinformation. Many people are not aware of the subtleties of these things that are often told to kids in very simplistic ways, and they get the wrong message, and then they feel terribly guilty. I read a mice in this article that there was a young lady I was treating who was molested by her stepfather for many years. And finally, a Beis Yaakov teacher was very helpful, got her out of the house. And now when she was older, she didn't want to go anywhere near where he was. So there'd be a family simcha, and if her stepfather was there and her mother was there, she didn't want to go there. And she, even the family members who knew what happened would harass her that she didn't have kibbutz avein. And as much as I tried to convince her that there's no kibbutz avein in this thing, she wasn't convinced. I finally wrote a letter to Rav Zilberstein, and I told him the whole ma'aseh, and he wrote back over there, he wrote on the side, the name is Mishpachta Shaitim Gemur. So when I showed that to her, it was Meniach Her Das. And there's a, I think I mentioned here also, there's a thing that they give out in schools for Midas, Project Derech or something. Okay. So one of the issues they spoke about Kibbutz Avein, they brought down the Mice of Dhamma of the Nesina, without, of course, Taisis. And they said over there, this is my quote, they bring down the Mice, and they give, and then he quotes from the Shulchan Aruch, quotes from the last page, in the indent, the second last paragraph. The key to such awesome self-control, this is a quote from the Shulchan Aruch. The key to such awesome self-control, no, it's not responding, is developing the proper attitude. We are instructed, one should not respond negatively to his parents, but should remain silent and fear the mouth of the Amlok, who had instructed himself. Okay? For were a mortal king to instruct us to fulfill a difficult request, would we question his instruction? Now this is an editorial comment over there. For example, if Saddam Hussein told you the sky is purple, would you dare to argue? What do you think about that? This is given out in yeshivas.
Yeah.
You think anybody noticed it? I called them up, the people put it out. You noticed it? Okay, I'm glad somebody did. I called and complained. They told me they'll speak to the Rebbe and get back to me. I never heard from them. It's insanity. Can you imagine giving this out to get? No, the reason why you have to listen to your parents, because the Rebbeinu Shlom, who's Saddam Hussein Rahman Lutzan, right, is going to come and beat the heck out of you if you don't listen to them. That's why you're supposed to listen. This is exactly what, this is what kids are taught.
So
can
you explain to the kids what I can ask?
Okay, so I really discussed it very much in length here. It's 9 pages, and you know, yeah, sure, you can pick up a few things there you can pick up afterwards. You know, obviously I emphasize I'm not passing any shilas, but I think people have to know. What happens is people go to a Rav, and they don't understand what to tell the Rav, because they're difficult and embarrassed to say half of the... I had a nice one to do with this, it was Rav Dovid Cohn. Somebody that I know told me he had a mice. He has a brother-in-law whose parents were very abusive with him, and now that he's married with children, he hesitates going to visit them, because every time he goes, you know, his father abuses him again. But he feels very guilty if he doesn't go visit. So I said to him, you know, call him double call. You know, I don't think you're willing to subject yourself to that. But I get back a message that, yeah, he spoke to Rav David. Rav David said, "Who said mitzvahs have to be easy? You gotta go." So I met Rav David at a simcha a few days later. I said, whoa, what did you tell this guy? You know, that's not what you've been telling me. He said he told me it's not so pleasant when he goes visit. Who says ask me so pleasant? I said, that's not the whole story. He says, well, I'm not a nubby. You know, tell him to call me up and tell me the truth. And okay, once he told him the whole story, he told him you don't have to go. You know what I mean? So this is very common. This is what happens. They don't tell him the whole story. Yes.
How, being in the non-religious world, you have a pretty much non-existent question. How does one do it over in a way that they're doing honor and respect at the same time?
When the parents act in a respectful way, and the kids learn in yeshiva all about the yeshivas of the mitzvah, and the parents tell the kid the halacha, nothing wrong with telling a kid that the Shulchan Aruch says you're not supposed to sit in the parents' chair without a Shulchan to give you a shush. It's not such a difficult thing. But, you know, I mentioned the last time, the Rosh Hashanah Fall verse says, anybody who thinks his children are going to respect him, if he doesn't treat them with respect, has another thing coming. Especially if it's, you have to earn it. Of course, a child has to know there's such a Musik, and you're right, in the secular world, the whole Musik doesn't exist. So, of course, it's very important that the child should, but it's a two-way street. You know, they both have to, each person has to play their part. Okay, now, it's very helpful, you know, it's very important for kids to know that things that happened to them in the past has an effect on their present. There's a trend, very often there's a denial of that no matter what happens in a person's past, it should have no impact on his present. And it's really, we've seen Chazal, I don't know, the famous Ibn Ezra, it's very interesting over there in Bishala. He says, why the Yidden didn't fight back when the Mitzvah Korn got them by the Yamsuf? The Yidden outnumbered them with large numbers. So why didn't they fight? He says because they were treated like avodah for too long. They had the mentality of avodah. And he even says, this is kind of mind-boggling, but he says that the reason why the Yidden had to die out, one of the reasons why the Yidden had to die out in the Midbar is because they had the mentality of avodah, and they never would have been able to go there to Israel and start their own country. It's quite amazing. That's what he says. And nobody told the Yidden, just get over it. Now, I very often have, when I try to describe to a parent that who even admit that they were very abusive to the child, and I say, well, that's why he's having a hard time. I say, what do you mean? Just get over it. So I reminded the mother, I said, you know, you haven't spoken to your sister in 15 years or for something she once told you at a wedding about your shekel. You know, why don't you just get over it? You didn't appreciate it. Also, similarly, you know, Chazal tell us why Moshe Rabbeinu had to grow up in the house of Paroi. Because he needed to grow up in the house of a king and be a prince. So we see, you know, to get over something, you first have to live there. So you can't get over something before it's acknowledged. You see it clear in the whole Indian, the Indian of Avelis. Right? If somebody's an older Rahman al-Islam, you don't tell them, get over it. For 7 days, you do nothing but talk about it. You live it, you live in it, mom, you're not allowed to even see it, bash on it. You know, after you live in it, you experience it, people give you emotional support, and people feel for you and acknowledge your loss, then you can get over it. You can't get over it if it's never acknowledged. In fact, you see, you can't mourn from somebody to it's like a mechila. You know, people are very easy in demanding on somebody else they should be mindful. Now somehow they don't demand it of themselves. I saw a very interesting thing, from the recent mishpacha, they had an Hebrew mishpacha, they were saying that Rav Shach used to say that, you know, he was funny, people said nasty things about him. He said he's Michael everybody for whatever they said. The only people he was not Michael, the people that claim that the reason why they had the split was not good is because he hates Hasidim, he'll never be Michael then. That Alila he's not going to be Michael then for. He had a right to do it. I'm going to be Michael everything. He said that he's not Michael for. I saw once there was a Michael with the Malden that his wife ran a business so he could sit and learn. When he left, he tried to leave the Rabbanus for a while, so his wife went into business, and she had a partner who robbed her blind. So he got up in shul and gave a clap on the beam, and he said, I'm Michael the guy for being a ganev, but I'm not Michael and I have to go back into Rabbanus. people are allowed to be, have their feelings. Yes?
Jack said that with the smoking.
Say what?
Jack said he's Michael the person teaching him how to smoke. He's not Michael the talent to help him learn, but he could learn. No, he said it.
Really? Yeah. Interesting, I never heard that. Yeah,
he said that. The guy told him that he's going to learn better with the smoking. Yeah.
Interesting, yeah.
Many times when a person holds in their anger, when
that doesn't happen, they know that
there's a mitzvah
called Yidden that tells
the person how they feel as opposed to keeping it in and being over on this Yeah. But there's a problem. Usually the person holds in is a lack of confidence in approaching.
Yeah, sure.
There's a tension involved in
the
person. How does the person get over that? How do you
defend
somebody?
So in therapy, one of the things you do in therapy is a very important part of therapy, because very often, maybe because of their own experience growing up, when things were expressed, they're expressed aggressively. So in their minds, the only two options are being passive or aggressive. You either keep it in or you get into a fight. And they're shocked to learn there's actually other ways you can bring things up. You know, there's a mashgiach, a wonderful mashgiach, and a certain yeshiva. I had a lot of shaykhs with him. He was very open to these things and very into it. But I used to get all the bachurim come. They always complain about the chavrusas. Oh, and he would always try to handle. You know, he was like a marriage counselor, but he would like always dealing with chavrus issues. I once told them, I said, you know, it's really nice how dedicated you are to trying to help these bachurim. I said, but how are they supposed to get married? They can't talk to their own chavrusas. The guy's not happy with chavrusas. Chavrusas always coming late, so he goes and talks to the mashgiach. You know, why don't you talk? Yeah, Imam. I said, you know, you should teach him how to, when they come to you, teach him how to speak to the chavrusas without getting into a fight. He says, you talk it right, I'll talk to do it from now on. You know? Yes?
How would you explain about someone else?
Yeah, it depends on the context. In other words, I don't think, this rub that I wrote to about the stepfather who abused her, I don't think, you know, she will clearly make for such a thing. It's like, you know, it's like the revolt. First of all, it depends on the person apologized. The Shaima Hyman writes that the part of the mechila, of asking mechila, is the person who did wrong has to sit there and mamish think about the terrible outcome he did and all the harm he caused and the harm that he could have caused. And such a person comes and asks mechila, so then there's a need to be mindful of the person. Right? But you know, very often the person who hurt, very often, you know, parents will tell me when I'll talk to them about, let's say, why the child's upset, what things that they've done to him in the past, which they don't deny. They'll say, oh, come on, he's living in the past. The past is the past. You have to move on. I say, first of all, it's still happening in the present. It's not the past. And second of all, it's not your place to say you have to move on. You have to be apologetic. Somebody wrote a wonderful book about the whole issue of forgiveness, one of the few that's written from a Jewish perspective, not a Christian perspective. And she writes there that if you want the person you hurt not to obsess about what you did to them, you have to obsess about it. I'm saying if a person sincerely apologizes and really tries to correct what's wrong, there is a need to be Michael. It's not that you can't, you know, it depends on the circumstances. I guess Rav Shach Held, for instance, is an example that he said, it was Michael a million things, you know, the funny things were done wrong. He felt that this was such a harm and the people never really regretted what they did. He didn't feel that he has to be Michael. Yes?
Just to explain, someone says, oh, he's living in the past.
Yeah.
You wait another 20 years, this is probably happening with your child.
Right, also being the past. Good. Yeah?
I don't think there is such a statement.
Which one?
If you're not Michael, someone has chosen Michael.
No, it says if you are Michael, then the bank goes model on the dice. That's what I mean. Right. It's a good point. Right. Doesn't say that the best is that. Right. Good gazelle. Okay, now another important point is the way you can help a child grow emotionally is by emphasizing self-esteem. I mentioned this a little bit last time, I think, but I want to reiterate that usually when people have problems with their self-esteem, they put all their kaiches into impressing other people. That becomes their life goal and their life task, and all day they're busy trying to impress other people. Impressing other people does absolutely zilch for a person's self-esteem because it's not focusing on the person's self. The whole issue, and what ends up happening is that people feel like phonies, because they feel they're impressing everybody else and they don't believe it themselves. And that's why very often when you'll see, and very often when they have meetings about kids who are having problems with their self-esteem, very often the expression that a teacher or other people will use, you have to give the child opportunities for success. Right? Very common. You know, you give opportunities for success. Find something you're good at, give opportunities for success, and then he'll have self-esteem. Everybody probably knows people who are tremendously successful have absolutely no self-esteem. Success by itself does not breed self-esteem. A person has to know how to interpret success. You have to have the tool to transform success into self-esteem. People who are very self-critical never consider what they do successful. As I mentioned last time, they snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. Whatever they do, they can punch up what's the big deal? I just got lucky. Whatever they do wrong is done, they're responsible. Whatever they do right is only they're lucky, or they had it easy because somebody helped them. They always have a tendency to touch up. If you want to help a person build self-esteem, you have to check if he's building self-esteem, not because he's impressing you. When a child tells you, you should be proud of me because I did such and such, you say, no, you should be proud of yourself. Are you proud of yourself? And I often ask patients when they tell me something that they accomplished or something they overcame, say, are you happy with yourself? 9 times out of 10, they tell me no, it's lucky and this and that. You know, they have a terror, so why not to give themselves credit? So it's not automatically, it's a chachma, you have to help somebody develop self-esteem. Yes.
So there's someone who has that problem by telling him, are you happy about yourself? He might say, he's time that he knows himself better.
I'm not saying it's easy, but at least he's aiming in the right direction. You want to at least make it clear to him that that's not going to help him impressing everybody else. He has to believe it himself. Sometimes even with therapy, it could take a long time to get them to start. Sometimes you see you're getting someone in therapy when the guy for the first time gave himself credit for something. It's like a kiddush or such a thing. It very often takes a lot of work to get that done.
Well,
part of it is when you recognize, when a person truly recognizes why something is unusually difficult for himself or herself. One of the reasons people don't give themselves credit is because they don't recognize it. It might be something that's easy for other people, but for them it's very difficult. So, if you try to get them to give themselves credit for it, they'll say, yeah, what's the big deal? Everybody does it. Other people's not difficult for you. It's difficult. Now, when you become more aware and you give more credence to why something is particularly difficult for somebody, so then it's more likely that they can give themselves credit. Well, there's a lot of ways. I mean, different, but it's really giving yourself credit. That's what self-esteem means, is appreciating what you do. You find different situations where that comes up. Now, self-esteem is only possible in a non-competitive environment. Somebody told me that that the Rabbi Grizak spoke in Lakewood this past Shabbos, and he said over things that Rabbi Steinman said by the Tar Masorah convention, and he was saying that Bachrim today never do things because it's the right thing. Everything they do is only because of the competition and to beat somebody else. So it's not a terrible matzah. Right? When you have a very competitive environment, then it's almost impossible to build self-esteem. When Michal Yehuda Lefkowitz says in his sefer, and I guarantee you nobody listens to this, he writes it like this: Aleinu Rashi HaYeshivas Linoya Shiloi Yeh Tachros BeYeshiva. It's our job as a Rosh Yeshiva to make sure there should be no competition in the yeshivas. Omnam Amur Chazal Kines Sefer Tar B'Chochma. Right? Achushvani Shebezvanenu Ein Mishi Agil Adar Gizu Shal Tachros Mi'ila. Then our day, nobody knows how to have healthy competition, and the male is destructive, and we have to get rid of it. I guarantee nobody listened, but okay. So again, it's interesting that the Gemara talks about Kinesayim and Tarbel Chachma is not even talking about Hamidim. The Gemara in Bava Basra is talking about their being on Hasagus Gvul, and the Gemara is talking about that, you know, if you have a barber in your town, you can't, and get a new barber comes, gives better hair, because you can't get rid of the old barber. It says Parnasa, go find another place to be a barber. But if you have a Malamed in town and you find a better Malamed, so then you're allowed to get rid of the first Malamed in order to have the better Malamed. So I asked Rabbi Feinstein a few years ago, I said to him, it's very interesting that which the Gemara talks about where you say Kinesayim and Tarbel Chochma is not practiced. I never heard of any. You ever heard of they got rid of one Malamed, they found a better one? And he said, that which the Gemara doesn't talk about Tamidim, right, that they do practice. So he laughed, he said, you're right, but listen, they don't pay the Malamdim enough. If they didn't have job security, nobody would be a Malamed. So, you know, that's why it has to be. No, but I'm telling you, again, it's a Chazal, but it is used commonly in the Sfarim as a way of encouraging people, but there is a healthy Kinnis Seifrim. He speaks about it, Rav Hanoch Leibowitz and the Chiddush Ha'Aleh distinguishes between healthy Kinnis Seifrim and unhealthy Kinnis Seifrim. And he says the way you can tell is how would you feel if you got rid of the other guy who's your competition, right? So if you'd be happy about it, so that's assuming it's unhealthy Kinnis Seifrim. I think that's the way you can see it, yeah.
I think the yeshiva
The reason why competitiveness is so popular, in my opinion, is because it's a cheap substitute for inspired teaching. You know, why you have to work out to be inspired? You can get them to kill each other and inspire each other. Anyways, actually, the Gavolda in the Zriyo Binyan B'chinich, he writes that if you follow up, if you did a long-term study, and follow up on the kids who win the prizes and the Mishnayos contests and this and that, you'll discover that it doesn't pay. The poem the Rebbe I saw in the Mishnacha recently wrote that his grandfather was vehemently opposed to public testing of elementary school children. But I always find it very interesting that many of the same people who promote the competitiveness have a pachad of making it. Let's say if you're seeing a kid in therapy, he's having certain problems. Let's say you try to get the school or the Rebbe to make an exception for the kid. Something that's difficult for him to do. You want him to make an exception. The Rebbe said, no, you can't do that. I'll be jealous. Other kids will be jealous. How can you do that? How can you keep this one different? But these same people are very happy to promote competitive, you know, cutthroat competitiveness. I'm not sure why here suddenly they worry about this. In fact, there was one. I'm sorry? What do you know? I'm saying they're not worried about the bad feelings that it will cause. And if you make an exception for a kid because he needs help and he needs a special attention. I'll tell you this thing, there's a kid that came to me once, a boy that I was seeing, a very, very sweet boy. He was like a very ailish kid. So he told me he came one day very disturbed. He said that, you know, at his school, Friday afternoon after yeshiva, they go to the park and they play ball. So the Rebbe overheard them planning the game. So he asked the boy, let me ask you, when you play, do all the kids in the class get a chance to play? So the boy told him that usually they play each other, you know, within the class, so all the boys get to play. But once in a while they play another yeshiva, so then only the best players play. So he said, what do you mean, insulting the other kids? So he said, no, they don't want to play because they want the team to win. He says, no, and he got like very angry at the boy. He says, Mamsh, Azorius, how can you do this? You're not a Balmidas. And the Chayes, he Mamsh wiped the floor with him. And the kid like got very shook up about it. He, you know, he asked me, am I such a terrible person? So I don't know if I should have done this, but I guess I couldn't resist. I asked him, let me ask you something. Do you have Mishnayos charts in your class?
kids?
I did, of course we do. I said, are there bachurim in your class who try very hard but have very poor memories and don't do very well? And they're way behind everybody. I said, yeah, there's one bachurim who mamashi plugs away, but mamashi doesn't have a memory. I said, does it seem to bother your Rebbe that everybody walks in and sees that this guy's way behind everybody else? I said, it doesn't seem to. Yeah, that was that. In fact, that he writes about it, about this Mishnaichat, in the Siva Chinuch from the Son of Merebi, he says, Mamish, it's a terrible thing to have Mishnai's charts up on the wall. He's not Eshwav against it.
So what do our Bain do today?
I don't have the answer to that question. Because I really think that gets everybody working. Let's say that Taki, he writes that he writes that, you know, Michal Yehuda writes, I'll talk about Chavdes, he says that if you make an exception for a kid because he needs it, because if you, in generally, try to help each child in the class, al pidarkai, if you talk about the Indian of Chinuch of Chanech, and al pidarkai, if you make an exception for a kid because he has a special need, it will not cause jealousy among the other kids. Yeah, I want to tell you, yes, sir?
Is there a difference between the Mishnah's chart and the Venus chart?
I think any chart. I think anything that's out in public. You know, the kid should compete with himself, not with other kids. The kid should try to always get better and better, not necessarily with other kids. Yeah. I know. But the problem is, again, teaching bad, all the good, all, every goal that you talk about. It's what? What's acceptable? Who said? Maybe for one kid, let's say one kid has a terrible temper. For him, it's very difficult to do so.
I'm saying to participate.
You can participate, but you can't do as well. You don't get on the chart for participating.
No, I'm saying our chart's just for participating.
No, but it's very possible it's much harder for one kid than for another kid. One kid can have a much better memory than another kid, or whatever it is he has to do. Rav Yaakov Weinberg put it this way, in the Jewish Observer in 99, he said, the focus has shifted who knows things well to who knows things best. There's a bachur who told me, who grew up in a very, very competitive home, that the father encouraged it, the father who was a machaneh. He told the kid was very smart, he always told him, if you keep this up, you'll know more than, you'll do better than all your friends. He didn't say if you keep this up, you'll have access to be a talmud chacham, if you do this, you know, it's not what you'll do. You'll be better than everyone else. And this kid Taka plugged away for many years until a new kid came to the class who was much, you know, was brilliant, and he went to deep depression at that point. But that became his whole avodas Hashem, was to be better than someone else. Now, same thing, the issue of prizes, right? I mentioned a thing a little bit before. In the Sefer Chanoich, when Nari brings the name of Chaim Kanievsky, who said about his father, the stipler, he says, Abba Zatzal Me'ev Lo Yachaz Me'livu B'Shil Keser. The disciple was very much against learning for money. The af litain prasim li yaladim la hizik. He didn't believe in giving prizes to kids. Kedei shalei lahargilein lumay b'shil prasim. Rav Shach says in the Shemush Shel Taira, ein likreich limed taira betashlum tu v'tmura kaspis. I don't think we realize what we're doing. Again, push it. When somebody does something for money, teaches them to love money. It doesn't teach them to love fakir. If he does it for money, he doesn't even have to pretend that he likes what he's doing. He's doing it for money. Yeah. I think the fact that it's used so liberally, I don't think we realize the downside. I'm going to end, and then we'll have time for questions. So it was an interesting mic that just happened this past Shabbos. It's a Rebbe from a small yeshiva where they have Bachrim who, you know, not from the top Bachrim. It's geared for those type of Bachrim. So he told me, I don't know, the Bachrim Mamash have no cheshit to learn. If I don't go on the dormitory and drag them out, they won't come to fix matters. Like, what's the problem? I said to him, what do you think the problem is? He says, I think there's an Amakshif Taira. I said, I haven't seen a Bachrim in the last two generations who went to Yeshiva who's Amakshif Taira. I said, I don't think they're Makshif their own Taira. The Makshif Taira by Yenin, by the Devil, and by other people is Taira, but they don't value themselves. So he said to me, why is it that way? I said, most often because they've been criticized too much. And they're not much of anything they do. So he says to me, it's not true. The last 20 years, it's not like that. Everybody reads these swearing books that talk about you shouldn't criticize kids too much. It doesn't happen. I told him, Halavai, you were right. So 2 minutes later, I was having a conversation at a kiddush, there. I mentioned that somebody told me that in the yeshiva he learned in Eretz Yisrael, there were two groups of Bachrim, two yeshivas. One yeshiva, from one of the sifter where they came from, they were very makbid on davening, and the other yeshiva, they weren't so makbid. And in this new yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael, where they weren't makbid, not everybody showed up for shteitzach, but the ones who did were all from the yeshiva where they weren't strict about it. So from the yeshiva where they were strict, nobody showed up. Because as soon as they stopped being strict, nobody's standing over there with a gun. They stopped coming. They never learned how to come on their own. So the guy overhears me, it's a young father, he says, I don't believe the story. I said to him, why don't you believe the story? It's because that's ridiculous. What is he chinuch is all about? Chinuch is, you have to make him do it. I said, you could try inspiring the kid to do it. But that was like theories. Realistically, this is chinuch. So the other guy smiled at me. He says, he was just trying to sell me then this door, nobody does these things. So, I proved my point. Okay, any questions? Yes.
When a child has a problem that kids make fun of, okay, and the child's a good child, how are you supposed to deal with it that the child comes to you and says, what am I supposed to do? What am I supposed to do? He has feelings. So now, to help him say, we say, Hashem, that you have feelings and they're valid feelings, right? And they're hurtful feelings. But see, that he knows next step. Now what?
So first of all, you need to realize, I'm not sure what you can do about it, but it's important to realize that there's usually something that makes a particular child more vulnerable to be made fun of. And even if it's a physical, let's say the kid's very short, the kids make fun of him, he's very short. Not every very short kid is made fun of. But sometimes the reason why a kid's made fun of is because he's already been put down in some way. A kid who was put down a lot at home is more likely to be made fun of in school. So it's very often there's a reason why this particular child is vulnerable. As far as what to do with it, I'll tell you something interesting. When I first graduated, I worked in a school for very disturbed kids. It was a public funded thing. We had kids from all backgrounds, blacks, Hispanics, Hasidim, it was all kids that the none of the schools could handle. So our biggest fear was a race riot. That's all we needed. If somebody, now there weren't too many rules, and it was actually an excellent school, and we had great teachers, and we put up with almost everything. But the kids knew there's one thing we don't tolerate. You make a racial or ethnic comment, that's it, you're dead. And it was interesting, because they knew there was only one rule that we really took very seriously, I think in the 2 years I was there, I think we had like one mini incident. But this thing, you can get away, you can curse the teachers out, you can do whatever you want. This you can't do. So I think that when a Rebbe shows, when you want to teach a kid midas, I have an article here about teaching midas that was published in a book somewhere, that, you teach it by, if a Rebbe shows that he is more upset when one kid insults another kid than when a kid talks to him not with the most derecheres, right, it gives a value that it's not just because he's misbehaving. Because to you, it's not totally unacceptable. I have sometimes a parent will come and tell me that he has one of his kids in his family, all the kids make fun of. I said to him, what, this happens when you're not around? He said, no, it happens by the Shabbos table. I said, so what are you doing? I don't believe in getting involved. He said, no, what do you mean? He said, they're all ganging up on one kid and you do nothing. If you saw a bunch of kids beating up a kid in the street, you wouldn't come to protect him. But a kid, I think, if he sees that this is like totally unheard of, what do you mean? Stop hurting another kid's feelings? Usually the kids who do it are kids who themselves have not necessarily been treated the best way. You know what I'm saying? I think if a kid sees that this is like you just can't believe that, this is a very important thing, I think that could help a little bit. Yes?
How do you present it to the class about the issue of hurting someone's feelings?
By practicing it. A teacher once told me that after she herself was in therapy for certain issues, she had gotten very sick, whatever, but she told me when she became sensitive to these issues, she said that in her school, the principal would walk in and say an insulting thing to the girls in front of the whole class. And she said what troubles her more than that is that until now she never realized how terrible it is. It's now when it happened, now she was like horrified, like, how can you say this to a kid? There's a certain school that I, years ago, that very much pride, all their advertisements about how they teach me this. The contests and then prizes, and they're all big into me this, and I think I never heard kids being mistreated by teachers as bad as in that school. So it's like a waste of time. I think if Kid Taka sees that how important it is, the Rebbe, a setting an example, so that I saw from a Michal Yehuda, he writes now about setting an example. He says, in Israel there was a big tumult already for a few years about cell phone. You want to ban all the cell phone. So there was a big meeting a few years ago. All the Menalim and Rosh Hashivas, they're having a meeting about cell phones. So there came up ideas, all the yeshivas are going to ban cell phones. So somebody suggested it might work if all the Rosh Hashivas also don't use cell phones. And the Manalim, you know, should ban for everybody. So it says, he writes in the Sefer, the Rosh were horrible. I've got a cell phone, I have to raise money for the yeshiva, how can I not have a cell phone? The kids will understand that. It's obviously the difference between the Rosh Hashiva and the Talmidim. Kids are 6 years later, they have another emergency meeting about the cell phone. The Rebbe Chulia says, you know, if we would have banned it for everybody then, you know, it could be, it would have worked better. I think setting an example is probably the most effective way.
How does one, nowadays, in the day and age, how does one do what?
So first of all, again, who said, I mean, this might sound like a shikla of the courses, so you'll forgive me, who said that there's a big inyan to teach kids that every 3 minutes they have, they should be learning Mishnah about that? I'm just giving an example, or whatever.
I'm thinking yeah. class.
To do what?
Rebbe has a method
yeah.
nowadays.
Yeah.
They start off davening, talking about 10th grade.
Yeah.
And they sign off. That's a persuasive
The ones who are davening nicely.
The ones who are davening. And it's giving them a chance. And he constantly does that. He makes nice 1 minute on top of it. And he puts the name.
Not a prize. It's not a prize. We're just pointing out that they're doing well.
Yeah, well then, I mean, once they get on the board, they're eligible to be in the rabbi.
And what do you think would happen if the Rebbe would just individually tell each bachur, oh, because you're davening so wonderful?
No, he does that. They do that.
You don't think anything that would be enough? And let's say if you don't put on the board so they compare it to each other, what if you went over to the buffer afterwards and give him something, not like it's good for the call, but you know, to tell him, you know, I mom see that, you know, you're working hard in the davening, you're so nice, and you give him the candy. You know what I'm saying? Yeah, and not as a prize, not, you know, okay, you're going to do, no, you keep us up, you get a candy. But even if you give a prize, I don't know if I mentioned about the I heard this on a tape from Chil Jakobson in Eretz Yisrael, the big Mechanech. He said over that somebody was bragging to him, a friend of his, that he has the Chevres Tillim, and the Mamish, he's bragging about how much money he spends on prizes. That's one way today to say, you know, the more money you spend on prizes, it shows the bigger enterprise you have, you know. So he's telling Mamish thousands of dollars they spend on prizes. He says, so what do you gain out of it? When you get out of it, the kids, they say, Tillim, and I... So they're doing all for the prizes. No. So this Rebbe suggested, you know what? We'll ask the Talmidim why they do it. So Jakobson told him, you know, if you don't know by now that the Talmud is going to tell you what you want to hear rather than what he thinks, you shouldn't be in this business. So what's Eitzah? So he came up with an ingenious Eitzah. He told them to write, tell the boys that you're trying to, because there's a certain buffer, you want him to come, you're trying to convince him to come, he doesn't want to come. Everybody should write an anonymous letter without his name on it and write about why he should come. They collected the letters. There were 50 kids wrote letters. Only one wrote something ruchnius in the letter. All the kids wrote about prizes. You should come, you know, last week we had bamba and the orange flavor and the place and this and that. You have nothing to do anyway. You might as well come and get nash. Out of 50 boys, one boy, Abdul Ruch mentioned that to something ruchnius. That's the reason. And the Michiel told them, by the girls it's not like that. By the girls, try by the girls, you see it's not like that. He did it by the girls, almost all the girls grow up, you're doing something to Klai Yisrael, it's such a wonderful mitzvah, etc. What was the difference? The guy was like shocked. What's not the difference? So he took them and said, I'll show you the difference. He went to the place where they do it, he came where the boys are, the Rebbe is standing in front of the kids, he's pulling out from the bag of prizes and this. Look, boys, this little snack I got for you, isn't it kedai to come to Chevres Tillim? Everybody cheers. By the girls, the teacher had nothing to do with the snack. The girl sits in the back by the door. After the kids they come in, the teacher tells them what a mitzvah you're doing and such a chashuv thing and what you're doing for Klal Yisrael. When they leave, the girl gives each one her peckle of snack. She says, what are you selling? Here, selling how important it is. Okay, I'll give Urchi. You want it? You give him a snack. She says, what you emphasize? Because the people who do it don't recognize that there's a problem by using the motivator. That's and they're unlicked the thoughts. They think that as long as you get the person to do it, that's good. It doesn't matter why he's doing it, but it's a big mistake. It does matter. So sometimes you have to use a strickle something to make it, but you know, you shouldn't emphasize that. Yes.
I think the other thing is also sort of answer the question without really pointing it. You never met a kid that didn't care.
Yeah.
That really didn't care. That didn't have a drive to succeed. Okay, just that after
eventually becomes But if you build on the kid, but if every kid really does a natural diet and succeed, and you build on the kid with the nine times doing better, this, etc. Yeah,
you can replace them. You're right. 100%. You know, you always, you don't have to create a desire to succeed. It exists. You have to take away what's stopping it. Like I told that Rebbe, it's not the kid's not matzah tayer. He's not matzah of his own tayer. In his own eyes, you know, Ramuch Yehuda writes it also about why kids don't have a cheshit to learn, why they don't have a geshmak in learning. He says because in their mind, they have to know the sugya. Any kasha they have on the sugya means they don't know a word of the sugya. That's it. They don't know the sugya. And he always says, you shtai from the kasha, not he says over from his Rebbe, from Shai Bahaimah, you shtai from the kasha, not from the truth. If you understand clearly what you don't understand, it means you know the Zulia.
Changing the expressing.
Yes.
I don't know if I reacted correctly. I'm part of the baseball game in my class. I pulled the kid out on strikes, and the base was loaded, beat the fish, who else?
I pulled the kid
So right away, I told him to calm down. Yeah. Later on, we came back, I told the class that I've never been to a baseball game, but there has been a disagreement with the umpire.
Yeah.
I said, it's okay to tell you don't like the ball, but you got to stop here.
Yeah, listen, I mean, listen, if you're sympathetic to the person's pain, but explain to them there's not the way to express it, you know, there's other ways. Yeah, I don't think
it's okay to tell somebody.
Yeah. I think so, yes.
I think, though, in my class, I have children, when they want something, they want. And whenever they want, I tell them that I don't care what they want. Isn't that the correct?
Listen, it depends how they handle it. You know, I mean, again, you know, some kids, does it work most of the time? Is that, no, that's probably not a good idea. You know what I mean? Usually.
Maybe it's like if
you ask for it, they always say, right, I think if you say to them, you know, give them a chance on the spot to say the other.